from ABC News, World News This Week. And I'm John Grimes, ABC News. Listen.
This is a tremendous victory, not only for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but for anyone who cares about the safety of their loved ones on the highways.
The court has said that this activity is protected, and thus, for the flag to be protected, a constitutional amendment would be necessary.
It would appear that the minors have effectively quashed any, at least visible, opposition here.
A fly ball to right. Sierra down the line, coming hard. He's there. He's got it.
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's World News.
When Robert Windle was the world's best swimmer, he could swim over 1,400 yards in just 15 minutes. When Mike Burton was the world's best swimmer, he could swim over 1,500 yards in 15 minutes. When Michael O'Brien was the world's best swimmer, he could swim over 1,600 yards in 15 minutes. But if any one of them were out boating and suddenly had to swim to shore in cold water, it might not matter how far they could swim in 15 minutes. Because in that little time, their body temperature could drop to levels so dangerously low, they could pass out. It's called hypothermia, and it contributes to nearly half of all drownings caused while boating. So always be careful around cold water, and always wear your life jacket. That way you won't have to expend your energy and body heat staying afloat. Because hypothermia can kill you, even if you're the best swimmer in the world. A message from the National Safe Boating Council and the U.S. Coast Guard.
What's more important, keeping drunk drivers off the road or respecting a motorist's right to privacy? The Supreme Court has ruled that in a case involving sobriety checkpoints set up by state police in Michigan, the right to privacy comes second.
This is a tremendous victory, not only for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but for anyone who cares about the safety of their loved ones on the highways.
MAD had supported Michigan's sobriety checkpoint program, and so had various other groups, such as the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and its president, Brian O'Neill.
I think there's no question. There's good research evidence that sobriety checkpoints, where they have been implemented by police departments, have reduced alcohol-related deaths.
Kathleen O'Connor of the American Civil Liberties Union thinks the ruling gives police too much leeway.
There is no dispute that all of us are concerned about drunk driving, and there is a problem that needs to be addressed. The difference is whether you address it in a way that can violate the rights of individual people, and that's what we think the court has allowed in this case.
The ruling seems to reflect a changing attitude toward drunk driving, to support growing sentiment that the nation's highways should be made safer. Attitudes toward abortion have changed since the landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling that legalized it, and opponents of abortion rights have been mounting more and more efforts to get that decision overturned. The most recent effort comes from Louisiana, where ABC's Russ Wise tells us about a bill the state House passed.
Under the terms of the bill, a doctor could go to prison for up to 10 years and be fined $100,000 for performing an abortion, but the woman would not be punished at all. The sponsors of the legislation say Louisiana has always seen her as just another victim of an abortion, and they see no reason to change that now.
Democratic Representative Woody Jenkins is the bill's author.
We're trying to stop abortion in Louisiana. To do that, there may very well have to be a decision that affects the whole nation, so if that's what must be, so be it.
The Louisiana legislature's track record on abortion laws is not good. All of them passed over the last 15 years have been stayed or declared unconstitutional. John Cardinal O'Connor, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of New York, delivered his strongest and clearest statement yet on the subject of Catholic politicians who support abortion rights. He says they could face excommunication. New York Governor Mario Cuomo supports abortion rights as the state's chief executive, although he personally opposes abortion. And he says,
we cling to our Roman Catholicism as a consolation and a source of strength. And when someone suggests that they might try to divide that connection, it is profoundly disconcerting, but it's not going to change anything.
Cuomo and other politicians discount the threat of excommunication because of their public views, as do some church officials. The issue of flag burning has been in and out of the courts, and the constitutionality of the law banning such activity that Congress passed has been up for review by the Supreme Court. Solicitor General Kenneth Starr, who argued the case for the government, says this past week's ruling leaves little choice.
The court has said that this activity is protected, and thus, for the flag to be protected, a constitutional amendment would be necessary.
Senate Republican leader Bob Dole has long held that opinion and says the proposed amendment to the Bill of Rights is plain enough.
It's only 20 words, It says the Congress and states shall have the power to prohibit the physical desecration of the flag of the United States. Simple, straightforward, to the point.
Sean Eichmann was one of the people who burned an American flag on the steps of the U.S. Capitol to challenge the law. Wonders where the amendment will lead.
They're talking about a, quote, narrow constitutional amendment to protect the flag. Well, what comes after that? A narrow constitutional amendment saying you can't criticize the flag? Then a narrow constitutional amendment saying you can't criticize the government? You know, it's basically just another goose step towards fascism.
Congress began debating the proposed amendment during the week, and one of its sponsors in the House, Mississippi Democrat Sonny Montgomery, is aware of the uphill fight.
In my opinion, it's not going to be easy to get two-thirds vote in the House of Representatives.
Which is what's needed for the amendment to pass, the same margin required in the Senate. And then 38 states have to approve before the Constitution's changed. The freedom of expression being debated in the flag-burning issue is also being challenged in the music world. Two members of the rap group Two Live Crew were arrested in Florida this past week.
They performed songs from the album Nasty As They Want to Be. Last week, federal judge Jose Gonzalez had ruled the album to be obscene. The deputies used that as probable cause for arresting them for violation of the Florida state obscenity statute.
The two singers were released shortly without having to post bond. The Florida law under which the two were arrested contains language from a Supreme Court ruling which lets local community standards decide what's obscene. Lewis Seidman, a Georgetown University law professor, says the ruling is too vague to be much help.
Some people thought that Andy Warhol paintings were great works of art. Other people thought they were soup cans. And because of the vagueness of it, artists have to guess at their peril whether they're likely to be arrested for it. And many will end up not doing things that they have a right to do because they're afraid of going to jail.
So far, Two Live Crew's album is under fire in five states. And sales are booming. When the summits President Bush and Gorbachev just held ended, it appeared as though little progress had been made on the issue of Lithuanian independence. But no sooner had the Soviet leader returned home than he met with the heads of all three Baltic republics.
I think it was good news. I don't want to overstate it, but I was very, very pleased to see this occur in the wake of our what I think was a successful summit meeting.
President Bush was even more pleased when the Kremlin eased some of its restrictions on fuel to Lithuania. For its part, the government of Lithuania proposed that the Declaration of Independence be suspended while the talks take place with Moscow over the future of the republic. ABC's Anatole Levin in Vilnius says the move could break the current impasse.
If accepted by a possibly hostile parliament when this meets early in the week, it would clear the last apparent obstacle to the beginning of negotiations on independence between Vilnius and Moscow. The Soviet government has promised to end its economic sanctions as soon as the moratorium is introduced. However, the Lithuanian draft says that the moratorium would be only for the period of negotiations and that it will automatically end if these are broken off. Anatol Levin, ABC News, Vilnius.
Meantime, Mikhail Gorbachev sustained another political setback when the Soviet parliament rejected his plan to wean consumers from state subsidies by refusing to approve a steep increase in the price of bread. There has been unrest in Bucharest, the capital of Romania, as protesters challenged the leadership of the new president, Ion Iliescu. Thousands of coal miners answered the government's appeal for help and descended on the capital to beat the demonstrators into submission. ABC's Hillary Bowker says they were successful.
It would appear that the miners have effectively quashed any at least visible opposition here. People are not talking against the government. If they're talking, they're talking about leaving the country. People here know that if they go outside and miners stop them, there's nothing to protect them. The miners are at this point perfectly free to stop people they wish to stop, to beat them up, to take them into custody. Where they go, at this point, nobody seems to know.
The State Department responded by cutting off aid to Romania, except for food and medical supplies. There are also demonstrations in Bulgaria to protest the election of the new socialist government there, the protesters charging vote fraud. BBC's John Lawrence in the capital of Sofia says the demonstrations are not altogether unexpected.
Conservatism has very deep roots here. One of the reasons that the Soviets controlled and dominated it so much after World War II was that Bulgaria actually allied itself with Nazi Germany and even declared war on the United States at one time.
And thousands rallied in Belgrade to call for free multi-party elections in Serbia, the largest of Yugoslavia's six republics. Israel's new prime minister, Yitzhak Shamir, has laid down tough new conditions on his plan for peace talks with the Palestinians, making them an even more remote possibility. And that frustrates Secretary of State James Baker to no end.
If that's going to be the approach, and that's going to be the attitude, there won't be any dialogue, and there won't be any peace, and the United States of America can't make it happen. You can't. I can't. The president can't. And so it's going to take some really good faith, affirmative effort on the part of our good friends in Israel.
And Baker told the House Foreign Affairs Committee the White House is ready to listen if there's a change of heart.
Everybody over there should know that the telephone number is 1-202-456-1414. When you're serious about peace, call us.
At the same time, the administration says it's still disappointed that the PLO has failed to condemn a recent raid on a Tel Aviv beach by a faction of the organization, although the PLO has announced that it has started an investigation into it. Another of the key players in the Iran-Contra affair has been sentenced, and for the first time, a prison term is involved. John Poindexter, who was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor, was given 6 months for committing five felonies, including lying to Congress. Dan Webb of the Independent Counsel's Office says the jail term is merited.
In these types of cases where high government officials commit crimes, it's been my view that jail sentences are clearly a deterrent impact and pass a strong message on to public officials that when you serve in high government office with that responsibility, that you must do so at the highest levels of integrity and honesty.
Poindexter is the highest White House official since Watergate to be sentenced to prison for illegal acts committed in office. He will appeal. The Senate Ethics Committee began its hearings into Senator David Durenberger's conduct during the week and got a recommendation from committee counsel Robert Bennett.
Special counsel recommends that this committee report to the full Senate a resolution denouncing Senator David Durenberger for conduct which is reprehensible and which has brought the Senate into dishonor and disrepute.
The Minnesota Republican then made an hour-long presentation to the committee members, telling them repeatedly,
I recognize that real damage has been done by what has been perceived as my desire to push the limits and take advantage of the Senate. And for that, I am deeply sorry.
Durenberger said he would not contest the evidence against him. The committee voted unanimously to end the public hearing, effectively sparing the senator from what was expected to be embarrassing testimony about allegations that he violated Senate rules and federal laws in complex financial arrangements intended to supplement his Senate income. The committee expects to make some kind of recommendation on punishment to the full Senate in a few weeks. Another politician under fire has decided not to run for re-election. Mayor Marion Barry told the people of Washington, D.C.,
my announcement tonight is the best thing for me personally, best for my family, that is my wife and son, and also for my beloved city that I respect so deeply.
Barry is currently on trial on 14 drug-related charges. Six candidates have said they'd like to replace him as mayor of D.C. The war that Colombia's government's been waging against the drug cartel has exacted a high price in human life, a price raised again during the week by the death of a cartel leader and another bomb attack against innocent civilians. Police shot and killed the man they say masterminded the 10-month campaign that has killed hundreds of people. And as ABC's Sarita Kendall tells us,
the killing of John Jairo Arias seems to be a very important one. The commander of the police operation said that it was the most important police success since Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha was killed last year. But already the drug war has been stepped up again with a new car bomb, and the traffickers say that it's going to go on.
Meantime, for the first time in nearly 10 years, the wholesale price of cocaine is sharply rising in a number of U.S. cities. The indication is that demand is outstripping supply, And the director of the National Drug Policy, William Bennett, takes some of the credit for that.
We're putting some tremendous pressure on drug traffickers, and I think it's starting to pay off.
But Bennett is quick to add,
no one should be lulled into thinking that this is the end. We got a long summer ahead of us. In some of our communities, as there is a shortage of cocaine, there will be violence as a result of that, and crime as a result of that. There will be the same number of dogs fighting over a smaller number of bones.
The higher cocaine prices have been noticed over the past 3 to 6 months, and officials want to let a few more months go by before they draw any firmer conclusions about the effect that law enforcement is having on supplies of the drug. Heavy rains and resulting floods have caused more than their share of misery in many parts of the country this year, and they did again this past week when a wall of water crashed down on homes around Shadyside, a rural town in eastern Ohio.
Mostly Mobile homes were hit really hard, and they said there's houses in Shadyside, that below Shadyside, that just totally is the foundation.
Rob Stotva was in one of those homes.
It happened in a matter of seconds. It just happened. You didn't have no warning, no nothing.
The flash flood killed more than a dozen people in the area, and dozens more were reported missing. Amber Colvin was one of the lucky ones. The 9-year-old girl had taken refuge in a bathtub just before her house collapsed, and she was swept away. Rescuers eventually found her 7 hours later, some 7 miles from her home. How'd she survive?
When I first came up in the water, I found a log, so I had to grab onto it or I'd drown.
Amber has some scrapes and bruises, but otherwise appears to be in pretty good shape, considering her ordeal. A potential environmental disaster appears to have been averted in the Gulf of Mexico off Galveston, where crews have been trying to prevent a major oil spill. A fire aboard the Norwegian tanker Mega Borg threatened to send 38 million gallons of light crude into the Gulf, but the fire was contained. Some 4 million gallons did spill out, but most of it was burned off, evaporated, or recovered. Lieutenant J.G. Robert Garrett of the Coast Guard says that special bacteria are being used to treat the remaining oil.
Instead of using chemicals to break up the oil and cause it to disperse, the oil would be attacked, eaten, and digested by these bacteria.
And Petty Officer Michael Sams is optimistic about the amount of oil that will eventually wash ashore.
We're anticipating the warm weather will disperse the oil into the atmosphere, and the wave action will also contribute to that.
As for the effects of last year's huge oil spill in Prince William Sound, a newly completed study shows that oil remains on one-third of the Alaskan shores polluted by the Exxon Valdez. With the liability risks growing for polluters, the Royal Dutch Shell Group, the world's largest oil company, has made a decision.
We will no longer use our own oil ships that we man ourselves to deliver what is termed black oil, that's basically crude oil and heavy fuel oils, to any U.S. port other than the Louisiana offshore oil port.
Shell official Richard Tukey, who says his company will continue to ship those oils which evaporate quickly if they're spilled, gasoline, jet fuel, and the like. The week's economic news contained largely positive developments. The U.S. registered its second smallest trade deficit in 6 years during April. Consumer prices were up only 0.2 of a point during May. Industrial production was up last month, and retail sales were down. And that combination leaves economist Cynthia Latta with a puzzle.
If consumers aren't buying and factories are pushing out the output, where is it going? And it might be going to foreigners, of course, in which case that's good news, or it might be piling up on the shelves, which is not particularly good news. And at this point, we don't know which of those explanations is more correct.
In another note, the New York Stock Exchange announced that for the first time in its 200-year history, it will begin trading after its normal hours later this year and hopes to start trading during the night in 1991. Nearly every major developed country in the world provides some kind of family leave for its citizens. In fact,
South Africa and the United States are the only two countries that don't provide family leave.
That being said, Democratic Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut joined his colleagues in voting to send President Bush a bill requiring employers to give workers up to 3 months on paid leave for family emergencies. Mr. Bush says he'll veto it because he doesn't think forcing businesses to provide benefits is a good idea, although he supports the concept of family leave on a voluntary basis. Wild time in Detroit Thursday night. All the whooping and hollering, was for the Pistons, who'd beaten the Portland Trail Blazers 92-90 for the National Basketball Association Championship. And for MVP Isaiah Thomas.
It's a wonderful feeling, but it's very gratifying that our team played so well. I think our team really played extremely well. And I was just lucky enough to be the MVP.
Not so lucky, people such as Armor Naimi, one of the many store owners whose establishments were vandalized by fans turned rioters.
They broke in the door and about 300 people came in the store, looted, tore all the freezer doors, shelves upside down, just looted everything they could loot. They just made a mess out of the store completely.
Several people were killed and many more injured before Detroit police were able to get the crowds quieted down. The crowd in Oakland may not have liked watching the A's get shut out this past week, but at least it saw a little baseball history being made.
Here's the windup of the pitch. Swung out on a fly ball to right. Sierra down the line, coming hard. He's there. He's got it. It's a no-hitter number six.
Nolan Ryan of the Texas Rangers, who at 43 is twice the age of many players in the majors, has thrown more no-hitters than any other pitcher in history.
Well, I think you feel relieved. I think what's really touching is how excited and supportive your teammates are, and I think that really affects me emotionally. Not so much that I've gotten wrapped up in it as much as what that means to you to have that kind of support from your teammates.
Ryan threw his first no-hitter in 1973. He also has struck out more players than any other pitcher in history. Take the bus and leave the driving to, well, that story when World News This Week continues in a moment.
This is Hugh Downs for the U.S. Space Foundation, presenting Frank Sinatra and Willie Nelson.
William, it's obvious that you and I do not share the same tailor. What do you call that thing up there?
I call it my way, Francis.
Touché.
Right on.
But we do share the same feeling about the benefits of space technology, don't we?
That's true. It's led to a lot of things that have helped all of us, city dudes and country cousins alike.
Take a look at one. It's called medical imaging. The images it generates are in color and more detailed than X-ray. Even subtle changes in the small arteries show up.
They give a doctor a clearer picture of what's going on inside your body.
They can help him spot trouble without exposing you to harmful radiation.
And this medical imaging stuff is just one of the thousands of down-to-earth ideas that have come from space research.
What this casually dressed gentleman and I have found out and want you to know is a lot of what's going on up there
benefits all of us down here.
Space technology.
This is what's in it for you.
For more information, call 1-800-255-1000.
Picture this. You get aboard a Greyhound bus in Delaware, and while you know the regular drivers are on strike, you figure the trip will be all right. Rosa White felt that way until the replacement driver narrowly missed a truck and then turned around.
The bus driver announced that Greyhound hadn't trained him to drive the stick shift bus, and he didn't know how to shift the gear, and he couldn't drive the bus. So one of the passengers volunteered, said that she had driven a bus before, and he let her drive.
Did so well, the passenger drove all the way to New York. Turns out she drives a bus for another company for a living. Is Greyhound thinking about offering her a job?
We might talk to her about that.
And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin. Engineering by Angel Bourdon and Tian Trong. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.